Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends and neighbors. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. And on this Friday, April 26th, welcome to this week's Reporters Roundtable. Another busy week and another week's news dominated, it seems, by Donald Trump and his trials. Yesterday, historic hearing in front of the Supreme Court on whether a president of the United States is not held by the laws that he takes an oath to defend. And of course, Trump's ongoing trial up in New York for election fraud. But there was other big important news. After Speaker Mike Johnson defied his extreme right-wing Republican opponents in the House, I shouldn't say opponents, but colleagues in the House and Senate passed the bill sending more military aid to both Ukraine and Israel, which President Biden, of course, immediately signed into law. A big surprise in Pennsylvania's Republican primary when more than 100,000 Republican voters said they'd still rather have Nikki Haley than Donald Trump as their nominee, even though she dropped out weeks ago. And what do you know, there are once again protests on college campuses, including yesterday at George Washington University in Washington. Here today to help us sort it all out, Igor Babish, senior political reporter with HuffPost. Welcome back, Igor.
Thanks, Bill.
Sarah Weyer joining us again, Washington reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Nice.
And also good to welcome back Brian Beutler, creator and publisher of the Off Message newsletter, which I subscribe to, encourage you to do the same. And Brian's also co-host of the Politics Podcast. Welcome to you all. I think most of you know that I've been out of the country. I'm actually joining you today from Bologna, Italy, where I've been enrolled in an intensive Italian class for a whole month. And once in a while, I just kind of peek into what's happening back home. And it just seems to me it's Donald Trump all the time. Trump, Trump, Trump. Here is evidence, a little bit of evidence. Lester Holt starting off the NBC News last night.
The Supreme Court hearing Donald Trump's claims of immunity as his hush money trial resumes. The Supreme Court now weighing whether the former president can be tried for plotting to overturn the 2020 election. Mr. Trump, meanwhile, back in a New York courtroom. David Pecker testifying about the alleged catch and kill scheme to help Mr. Trump's 2016 campaign.
Oh, hard to keep up with it all. So, Sarah, let's start with the most important, I believe. The Supreme Court hearing yesterday, we always remind ourselves we cannot draw too many conclusions from oral arguments. But what did we learn? How's it look to you?
It was absolutely fascinating. I had the hardest time pulling myself away from the audio yesterday. But the most interesting thing we learned was the Trump's own lawyers agreeing that to the premise that a sitting president could order the assassination of his opponent. I think everyone kind of took a seat back at that. He had said that at the lower level, but no one thought he would repeat it to the Supreme Court. I never want to make any prediction about what the result is going to be, but listening to the different the questions being asked by the different justices, it seemed to indicate that they were leaning towards sending it back down to the lower courts and letting them decide on an issue-by-issue basis whether Trump had immunity. This would substantially stretch out the timeline for this trial. And, you know, day by day, it seems like Americans have less of a chance of hearing the results of this trial or even having the trial start before the 2024 election takes place.
Yeah, Brian, put it in perspective for us. How important is this trial? And what are the possible impacts if the court does opt not to rule, but just to send it back to the lower courts?
So I don't think the court could not rule and also send it back, right? Like, if they're going to send it back to the lower court for sort of further adjudication of whether Trump's actions leading up to January 6th came with any sort of presidential immunity, they'd first have to find, they'd have to rule that a category of actions that a president takes are immune from prosecution. And then they'd send it back down with instructions to the lower courts to suss out whether this thing Trump is charged with doing is immune from prosecution or not. So to me, I think the questions going forward are, how long does it take them to issue a ruling? Because if it comes in late June, it's already going to be really difficult for the district court judge, Tanya Chutkan, to schedule a trial before the election. And then what does the ruling say? And to me, it could say essentially one of three things. One is that there's no such thing as presidential immunity, at least the way Trump described it. There's essentially no category of presidential power that ring fences a president so that if they violate a criminal statute, they can't be prosecuted when they're out of office.
Mm-hmm.
The second kind of category of ruling that the court could issue would say something along the lines of, yes, there's like a narrow range of activities that a president has that really do need to be immunized from the criminal law. But Donald Trump's conduct described in the indictment, in Jack Smith's indictment, doesn't come anywhere close to it. So the trial can go ahead, but now there's this new doctrine of partial immunity. And then the third case is the one where there's definitely not going to be a trial before the election, where the ruling says, yes, a wide area of presidential power can't be reviewed by prosecutors in criminal courts. And so this has to go back to the lower court, and there has to be an issue-by-issue assessment of whether what Trump did is covered by the criminal law or not. Mm-hmm. And we all kind of have like low expectations of this court, I think, when it comes to like whether they're going to go to bat for Donald Trump. But, despite some warning signs that other people picked up on, I'm just genuinely not sure which of those three avenues the justices are going to walk down.
Do you agree, Sarah? Those are the three options that we probably.
Yeah. Realistically, uh-huh. I think that's what it's going to come down to.
Yeah. So, Igor, my understanding, again, with some distance, I'm not that totally up to date, but I believe that Donald Trump wanted to attend the hearing yesterday and for some reason was told he could not. But he did speak out about what he sees as the issue. This was up in New York in front of the other court case.
You can't do what you have to do and then all of a sudden get indicted and go through a process like I go through. You have to have immunity. You need presidential immunity to do the right thing. And sometimes you may do the wrong thing. I mean, that's possible, too.
So my question to you, Igor, if there were a bill in front of Congress saying the president was had enjoyed total immunity from the law, do you think there's any chance that bill would pass even a Republican-controlled Congress?
I doubt that. There are many Republicans who don't agree with his absolute immunity claim. But there's also a lot of Republicans who are going to back him up. And I think you're going to see some form of legislation, if not from Republicans and definitely Democrats, if the Supreme Court decides to, punt on this whole thing, which I think it's clear based on yesterday's hearing. They're just looking for an escape hatch. Justices who Trump appointed to the court over and over repeatedly said they did not want to discuss even the facts of the case. They didn't want to mention, his efforts to overturn an election, unprecedented. January 6th, of course, they were looking for a way out to say that, well, we're concerned that if we say something in this case, how that would affect future presidents. and mm-hmm. how it would limit them and their actions.
It was really fascinating that they took this at all.
Yes.
They had so many off ramps to not weigh this decision. And you know, if you take Trump out of the equation, they kind of had to. You know, this is an unsettled bit of you know, federal law and constitutional law, you know, how much immunity does a president have? But you know, did they have to take it right now? No. And they chose to. I've just been fascinated by that, of why they chose to take it now.
Go ahead.
When Sarah says they didn't have to, what they would have done if they didn't take the case was leave the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling on the constitutional question. Does a president mm-hmm. have immunity for his official acts while in office, and just let it stand? And that that ruling, it was a three-judge ruling, two Democratic appointees, one Republican appointee, said no, like the president has to be, can't be above the law, like the president can be immune from prosecution while in office, but there can't be any category of action where criminal law applies to everyone else in the country, but not the president. And they didn't do that. And so now we're going to see if there's any reason why they didn't do it. Is it to slightly modify that opinion, but let the trial go forward? Or is it to create this new category of constitutional law that says that for certain official acts, quote unquote, official acts, even if the president runs afoul of the letter of a criminal statute, there's nothing anyone can do, even when their term in office ends.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's jump up to New York now. We've seen 1 week of the trial. The jury is in place. We've had the first witness, David Pecker, and also a special little hearing on whether Donald Trump should be charged with violating the gag order. Igor, from my perspective, again, across the pond, it looks like this is the most covered and talked about trial since O.J. Simpson.
That's a good comparison. I mean, it is historic. We've never had a former president on trial before. And I think what you're seeing now is him raging, at stewing that he has to sit there every day and complain about things like the temperature and the cold courthouse that, you know, he's just like he's like any other defendant. And he's making this all about himself. Claiming repeatedly that his First Amendment rights are being violated while he speaks about it openly to the press every time he goes into the courtroom, you know, unironically.
And what I know, first of all, Sarah, can you cover the courts more than anybody else? How does this first week go for Donald Trump in terms of, you know, they tried several times to get the judge either to dismiss the case or to side with them. And jury selection and everything, and then David Pecker on the stand. Who won the first week?
It did not go well for Mr. Trump. I'll just put it that way. okay. You know, the David Pecker is, you know, the former editor at National Enquirer, and he laid out in a lot of detail this, you know, catch and kill scheme. That, you know, he would purchase stories that were negative about Trump and with no intention of ever running them, but preventing, you know, the people asking for the stories to be published from ever going to another publication. And he really made the case for the prosecutors that this was about protecting the Trump campaign, not about protecting Trump's family, which is the reasoning mm-hmm. that Trump has used. You know, he said, you know, I didn't want to hurt Melania. I didn't want to hurt my family. So I had to keep this story from becoming public, even though he says, you know, it didn't happen. He didn't have this affair. And, you know, we'll see cross-examination today, whether Trump's team is able to make any headway with Pecker and, you know, kind of disabuse the information he put forward. But, you know, at this point, it was not a good week for Trump. And, you know, we're still waiting to see how the judge rules on whether Trump has violated the gag order and what that punishment might be. I mean, with a man who's worth as much as, you know, the former president says he is, you know, $1,000 fine for, you know, being critical of a witness or being critical of, you know, the jury. doesn't mean much. And, you know, the Secret Service has said that they're already making preparations just in case he's sentenced to, you know, some jail time.
I thought that from what I've seen, Mitt Romney had one of the best comments about what's happening up in New York so far, Brian. Here is the still senator from Utah about what this case is all about.
I think everybody has made their own assessment of President Trump's character. And so far as I know, you don't pay someone $130,000 not to have sex with you.
But Brian, in effect, this is not about sex with a porn star, really. I mean, or is it what this case is all about?
I mean, for the court of public opinion, I think Donald Trump's moral conduct, you know, regarding his marriage and his family may be important. For the case itself, it doesn't really matter what Donald Trump was paying to keep hushed up. It matters whether he engaged A, first in creating false business records, which is illegal in New York, and B, what makes it a felony is if he did it in service of advancing some other crime. And the crime in question, or the crime that the prosecutors in New York allege he was advancing, was to interfere in the 2016 election. And so the question of whether the stories that David Pecker caught and killed were about the election is very important, right? Like Trump's lawyer's job is to instill reasonable doubt in the mind of at least one juror. And this idea that, oh, I only, you know, caught and killed this one story to protect Melania might be the kind of thing that instills reasonable doubt in someone's mind, except the prosecution may be able to show that his family already knew about this stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not like the National Enquirer had a bespoke relationship with Donald Trump centered around his relationships with Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels. If you go back and you look at the covers from 2015 and 2016, it was all, you know, Ben Carson, Trump's Republican rival, leaves sponges in the brain of a child he operated on.
Yeah.
Ted Cruz's father was in on the JFK conspiracy. And what Pecker testified to is we had an arrangement that was about the election going back well before the hush money payments were made, but the hush money payments were a part of that broader scheme. And so I understood, and everyone understood, that catching and killing the stories about Trump's affairs was about the election. It wasn't about some sort of personal interest Trump had in keeping his family from finding out what he was up to.
Yeah. Can I ask this may be a dumb question? Is catch and kill still a practice in the tabloid world?
Not at Off Message. At Off Message, we are.
How about the LA Times or HuffPost?
we've caught and killed many a story about a certain Bill Press. we're sitting on one now. You've done some bad things in Italy,
for which I thank you, and it's worth every penny. Igor, before we take a break and get on to some other non-Trump news, I just want to point out that the New York trial has also been making headlines in Italy and probably other European countries. I've got in front of me yesterday's paper from here, the Repubblica in Bologna, Italy, where the headline, you don't really need to speak Italian to understand or be an Italian speaker to understand, the headline is that Trump is accused of pagare la porno star per manipulare il voto, paying the porno star to manipulate the vote. So I think they're at least talking about the right issue there as well. All right, now enough about Donald Trump. Let's move on to some of the other news of the week after a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod and today's Reporters Roundtable. And then we'll be back and continue our look at the Newsweek with Igor Babish from HuffPost and Sarah Weier from the Los Angeles Times and Brian Beutler from Off Message. And today's Reporters Roundtable brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, America's largest and most diverse labor union. Hey, they're not just truck drivers anymore. The Teamsters, They represent every segment of the American labor force, from vegetable workers in California to construction workers in Las Vegas, brewery workers in St. Louis, and bakery workers in Maine. As they say, we represent everybody from A to Z, from airline pilots to zookeepers, under the leadership of President Sean O'Brien. We salute the Teamsters, thank them for their longtime support of the Bill Press Pod, and thank them for their great work for all Americans. Check out their website at teamster.org, teamster.org.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back with today's Reporters Roundtable here on the Bill Press Pod. Glad to welcome back Sarah Weyer from the Los Angeles Times, Brian Beutler from the newsletter Off Message, and Igor Babish from HuffPost. And here, Igor, you were probably in the gallery or in the reporters' room when the House vote on the bill to provide new funding for Ukraine and Israel was announced. Here is that announcement from the desk.
On this vote, the yeas are 311 and the nays are 112. The bill is passed. The House will be in order.
Okay, so Igor, this has been a long time coming and everything changed from almost overnight. What happened and how did it come about?
Well, I mean, you saw Speaker Mike Johnson finally decide that he wanted to put morality ahead of his political future and decided to hold a vote on this bill that the Senate passed shortly after. Now it's well on its way to Ukraine, the aid and military aid for Ukraine and Taiwan and Israel. And Mike Johnson, I think, surprised a lot of people in the fact that he allowed a vote on this bill. And he's gotten very glowing press for doing so. And of course, there's all these questions now about whether he will survive and whether Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Georgia congresswoman, is going to trigger a vote for his ouster. But I do have to say that, you know, the Senate originally passed this bill back in February. Mm-hmm. And the House sat on it for months, demanding, as Republicans demanded, you know, changes to border policy and all these things that cost a lot of valuable time on the battlefield in Ukraine. So I think the jury's still out on whether he will ultimately be seen as a hero, Mike Johnson, in this situation, or whether this costly delay has cost a lot of men and time on the battlefield.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Igor, but the bill that originally passed the Senate, I believe, did have some protections or some border improvements in the border or whatever the language related to the border, which the House Republicans did not find sufficient, right? But the final bill contains nothing for the border. Am I right?
It contains some additional funding, you know, for Border Patrol agents and things like that, but it did not contained the things they sought, which were sharper restrictions on who's entering and things like parole and reforms to parole. And these are things that they said that they would never accept Ukraine without. And of course, you know, you saw them completely back down, and a huge victory for Democrats and for President Biden.
Right. Leader Schumer was quick to, of course, salute passage of this legislation, and also to thank two Republicans who helped make it happen. Here's Leader Schumer.
I thank Speaker Johnson, who rose to the occasion, in his own word, said he had to do the right thing despite the enormous political pressure on him. And let me say this once again about my friend, the Republican leader. We were of one mind to get this bill done. It was our bipartisanship, our linking of arms together, that got this large and difficult bill through the Congress, despite many political ideologues who wanted to bring it down.
Whoa, Brian, this is kind of a blast from the past, right?
I mean, a little bit, as far as Schumer praising his Republican leadership. Yeah, a little bit. I mean, he's correct that on the issue of Ukraine, Mitch McConnell has been like an ally of the White House's and of Democrats. He's been like he seems earnestly interested in helping Ukraine beat back the Russian invasion, and he's been consistent about it. And he talks about it in substantive terms and not in political terms. The Mike Johnson story is a little bit different, and it's a little bit weird. You know, in addition to all the questions, Igor noted that his change of heart raises. To me, I wonder what he was thinking before he changed his mind. Right? You know, when he announced that he was going to put the bill on the floor and that he thought it was the right thing to do, he said, I mean, this is his version of events, is that the Biden administration gave me these briefings and persuaded me that I had been wrong and that this aid was very important. And so that's why we're going to put it on the floor and pass it. And the implication is sort of that the anti-Ukraine aid caucus in the House GOP is, you know, operating on bad information, like would be the generous way to put it. But, you know, that they've basically taken Russia's side in the war. But that was the side that Mike Johnson was on for 4 months. So if he had a change of heart, like, does he have any thoughts about, like, why he was wrong for so long? And, you know, does he regret having fallen under the spell of this faction in American politics that kind of wants Russia to win this war? I don't know if we're ever going to get answers to those questions, but, you know, by Mike Johnson's own light, he was incorrect, and it took Biden's patience and determination to change his mind.
So what do you think, Sarah? Is this a one-off, or is this like a sign that maybe we're getting back to the days when Democrats and Republicans, like when Joe Biden was in the Senate, when Trent Lott was Republican leader, could reach across the aisle and work together and get things done?
Oh, that's a heavy question. I think to some regards, I mean, they're going to have to with such a small margin. Mm-hmm. You know, Johnson has kind of allowed himself to be led around by the nose by the Freedom Caucus and has seen how little he's been able to accomplish. And it's just emboldened the Freedom Caucus. I mean, there was no punishment when they blocked rules. There's been no punishment by removing people from committees. In some ways, it's really weakened the speaker's position as a whole. And, you know, we're in a time in American history where the speaker is very powerful. At least it was under Nancy Pelosi for a very long time. And so it does raise questions looking forward about, you know, bipartisanship. I'm just not sure, you know, when the loudest people in the room are the ones who get all the attention, you know, is bipartisan work really going to be possible in the long run?
Igor, you mentioned Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's got this motion to vacate. She hasn't called for the vote yet, but she doesn't need that many votes, does she? Right?
No, I think she only needs two votes at the moment, given the makeup of the House. But we've seen a lot of, well, you know, several, up to a dozen Democrats publicly state that they would be willing to vote either present or for Johnson in order to save his job on that vote. So, you know, whether she goes forward with it, ultimately, I think he does survive as speaker, but whether, you know, how that affects his power, that'll be a different question, given that, you know, his opponents are going to say, you know, he's controlled by the Democrats, even though they're saying that already. Essentially, they're saying that he's already governing hand in hand with Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, and that, you know, that the Democrats are sort of running the show in the House.
It's safe to say, isn't it, that he will only survive as Speaker with the help of the Democrats?
Yes, I think that's right.
All right. So meanwhile, this week, on Tuesday up in Pennsylvania, there was a primary election. The Republican primary in Pennsylvania is a closed primary, which means only members of the Republican Party can vote in it. Even Fox News, it was so stunned by the results that they had to admit that this wasn't all positive for Donald Trump.
Biden took more than 90% of the Democratic vote in Pennsylvania's closed primary. But the surprise of the night came from the GOP race. There were still more than 100,000 voters casting their ballots for former candidate Nikki Haley. Now, you might remember she suspended her campaign last month after ballots had been printed.
What's this tell us, Brian? Over 100,000 Republicans in Pennsylvania, they'd rather have somebody other than Donald Trump and are willing to say so.
I'm honestly not sure what to make of it or what the implications are. I mean, you could read it two ways. One, and it's definitely true, it suggests some weakness that Donald Trump has among Republican voters. And, you know, Democrats, I think, are taking a lot of solace in that, in the hope that many of those people who voted for Nikki Haley in Pennsylvania will cross over and vote for Biden, or at least abstain from voting in the general election, and that you'll see this repeated across swing states. On the other hand, there's still national head-to-head polling, and it shows basically a tied race between Biden and Trump. And, you know, if you assume that those polls are close to accurate, then you could kind of interpret this as okay news for Donald Trump, because it suggests he has room to grow, right? If pollsters are calling people, including Republicans in Pennsylvania, and they're saying, I don't approve of Donald Trump, or I would vote for Biden over Trump, and yet the poll comes out even, well, some of those voters are presumably going to come back home into the Republican fold in November, and that should give Trump a little bit of headroom. So I think you could kind of read it both ways. But you know, there's also, you know, some data to suggest that Trump has essentially fully consolidated the GOP base, and that it's Biden who has work to do to keep Democrats together in November. And so, I mean, I look at the results in Pennsylvania and I find that kind of hard to square. He's getting 90%+ of the vote in the Democratic primary. But if he's the one with headroom, then it doesn't, you know, the tide polls aren't necessarily a huge cause for alarm for Democrats.
Right.
It's all just kind of a little bit complicated, I guess.
Well, it is also. And, you know, it kind of reflects, as I recall, Trump only got he got 50%, almost 50% of Republicans in Iowa did not vote for Trump. And then I think it was 40% in New Hampshire did not vote for Trump. So there is this soft underbelly that keeps popping up in the Republican primaries, as you say, Brian, whatever it means. Meanwhile, as you indicated too, President Biden is spending, you know, 2 or 3 days a week out on the campaign trail, at least part of those days on the campaign trail, and getting taking more and more shots at Donald Trump, intentionally, of course. Here's one of the latest. This is sort of a kind of a new Joe Biden on the campaign trail we heard this week.
By the way, remember when he was trying to deal with COVID? He said, just inject a little bleach in your vein. He missed it. All went to his hair.
Whoa, Sarah, what's Biden trying to do? Just kind of get Trump to respond?
I mean, perhaps. I have to giggle a little bit because, you know, during the 2020 campaign was all about, oh, you know, Joe Biden's campaigning from his basement.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump is severely limited on what kind of campaigning he can do now with the ongoing trial. He's in court 4 days a week, and there's even a chance it could stretch to 5 days a week. You know, and, but right now he's not been campaigning on those days off either. You know, Biden's taking advantage of that by doing as many campaign stops as possible, but he's really, he and the campaign have not been critical of Trump or when it comes to being in the courtroom. Like, he has not commented on it directly.
Yeah. They seem to have made a decision, right, not to comment on the trials, right?
What I've noticed is that Biden has essentially ordered the White House and the DNC not to comment on Trump's legal jeopardy, but his rapid response arm is making hay of the fact that Donald Trump keeps falling asleep in court. Mm-hmm. And so they will comment on him being like Sleepy Donald or whatever to kind of turn the tables on Trump, who calls Biden sleepy. But beyond that, they're not really saying much about the conduct Trump is charged with.
Okay. There was some polling that showed that, you know, Trump's support, where it was softest, was whether he was a felon or not. And, you know, it didn't necessarily have to be, you know, fully convicted. It's just this outpouring of information about, you know, what he's accused of has to have his campaign somewhat worried, because it's all people are hearing about Trump right now is, in some cases, things they already think they know, but more details of a scheme he's being accused of. You know, if they're not hearing him, you know, hold these massive rallies, they're just hearing from prosecutors and witnesses about what, you know, he's accused of trying to influence the 2016 election as well. That can't be good for him overall.
Okay. So I'd like to wrap with one last question, and just an open question to each of you about the campus protests that are now underway. You know, we've seen, obviously, Columbia maybe are the ones getting the most attention. Mike Johnson even went up there. USC. Unusual for USC. You might expect him at UCLA, not USC. Yesterday in Washington, D.C., George Washington University, students from Georgetown came over. I think even students from American University joined in. I guess my question is, isn't the campus where protests always take place, back to the free speech movement or Vietnam War? How important are these protests? And are we paying too much attention to them? What's it all about? Well, just a quick take from each of you. Igor, you want to start us off?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. There are historically where protests have taken place. And I think what you're seeing now is just kind of a recognition of the situation in Gaza and how bad it is. And the debate in the Democratic Party, especially among young voters who are skeptical of Biden, who view him as kind of old, too old, mm-hmm. and too aligned with Israel's government in this terrible war. And I think that Democrats haven't come to grips yet with how to respond. They are wanting to align with Biden ahead of the election on his support for Israel. But also you see Democrats going to places like Columbia. You know, you had Ilhan Omar go there this week to show her support for some of these kids who are protesting. As well as on the other side, you had more staunch supporters of Israel. House Democrats make the rounds as well, and I think it's a debate you're gonna see at the convention this summer in Chicago, where Democrats are expecting some of this kind of these camps to pop up, and it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
So, Sarah, it sounds like both sides are trying to politicize the campus protests, take advantage of them.
Yeah, I mean, we saw, you know, Johnson up at Columbia yesterday, kind of doing the tough man routine. There's a picture of him with his arms crossed on the stairs as the protesters yell around him, and they were yelling some things at him. But in some ways, it feels like Republicans are perhaps trying to set up these protests as the boogeyman for the 2024 election. And we saw, you know, previous Black Lives Matter, you had the, you know, the caravans coming up through Mexico. You know, if they can make this an issue about law and order and freedom of speech, It could potentially be used politically, even though we're seeing it across the country. It's not just like it's on these super liberal campuses. Right. It's popping up in Georgia. It's not just, you know, in Los Angeles and New York City.
Right. Brian, in fact, former President Trump said that Columbia was worse than Charlottesville.
Yeah, he would. The only edit I'd make to anything Igor or Sarah said is that if these campus protests spill into larger street activism over the summer, Republicans are going to have to pick between law and order and First Amendment ideas, right? Like they've spent much of the last 3-4 years sort of playing as tribunes for free speech, but they're the ones currently calling on governors in the states where these universities are located to send in the National Guard to sweep out the protesters. So, and I guess they can claim that that's some sort of like law and order position, but it's not really consistent with free speech. I think the import, like, is it really a big political deal that students are protesting a war in the Middle East? The answer just sort of depends on what happens after graduation. We're in the summer.
Yeah.
The campuses will slow down. Does it translate into another summer like we had in 2020 where sort of streets are flooded with young people protesting the United States government? And Republicans are, I think, essentially trying to engineer that, right? Like the actual war protesters are concerned because Republicans are trying to get the National Guard sicked on them. And then there are agitators on the periphery of the protesters trying to do the kinds of things that would force the campuses and the police to get involved. And so there's this sort of pincer movement trying to escalate things so that this carries on through May, June, July. And if that happens, then obviously I think it could transform into something that really does matter in the election. If you just focus on what's happening on the campuses right now in April, it does kind of look like the sort of roadblock coverage you see on cable news is a little bit excessive.
Right. And for what it's worth, I walked through the University of Bologna campus a couple of days ago. It is the oldest university in the world, the very first university in the world. And of course, there was a pro-Palestinian protest taking place with signs and speakers and the whole deal. So that's it for today. Great job, guys, for today's Reporters Roundtable. Thank you. Thank you so much. We won't let you go, though, without telling us what the one story that really caught your attention this week. We always call it our favorite story of the week, of all the things you either covered or did not, we've talked about or did not. Sarah, what was yours?
So this one was in several publications, but it was my favorite was the Los Angeles Times version. I'm going to give them a little shout out.
Of course, there you go.
But it was the reconnection between NASA and Voyager 1.
Mm-hmm. You know, that was exciting. Yeah.
Yeah. For 5 months, this 46-year-old conversation has been over. Voyager 1 has gone, you know, 15 billion miles away from Earth, and they were able to, recalibrate the coding so that it could be spread away from a damaged, nodule, and the conversations could resume. It's absolutely fascinating to me, and it's sad to think that they only believe they have another 3 years where they'll still be able to reach it. But you know me, I like a science story that has nothing to do with politics, and this one has made me happy.
We all look for those kinds of stories, I think. How about you, Brian? Any favorite story of the week?
Yeah, mine's sort of a microcosm of how Trump manages to sort of sap the dignity out of people who support him. So this is about his former Attorney General Bill Barr, who testified before the January 6th committee and has said essentially that Trump is unfit to hold office and that somebody else should be the Republican nominee. But Barr is also a very partisan Republican. And so After Trump won the nomination or locked down the GOP nomination, he, you know, kind of tried to sweep it all under the rug and endorsed Trump because somehow he thinks Biden would be worse. Trump, like, you know, had thrown Barr under the bus for being disloyal years ago. And when he commented on the endorsement, he wrote this. He said, "Wow. Former AG Bill Barr, who let a lot of great people down by not investigating capital V voter fraud in our country, has just endorsed me for president, despite the fact that I called him weak, slow-moving, lethargic, gutless, and lazy. Based on the fact that I greatly appreciate his wholehearted endorsement, I am removing the word lethargic from my statement." Thank you, Bill. So
yes, all the rest of the words stand, right?
Yep. So that was Bill Barr's reward for sort of like taking back all of his criticisms of Trump and endorsing him in the election.
Bill Barr clearly has not learned lessons from any of the other people so treated as well. And Igor.
I'm going to bring up a crazy story that was kind of close to home, D.C. here. There was a Maryland high school athletic director who he's been charged with using AI to duplicate the voice of a principal, his boss, and make him, you know, apparently made it look like he said all these racist and anti-Semitic things about the campus and the students there. And I remember this was a big story a couple months ago. You know, this went wild on the Twitters. People tweeting about this guy and all these questions started posed about early, probably about anti-Semitism on campus. And it turns out to have all been false. And this guy had just totally fabricated his voice. And it turns out that allegedly it stemmed from him being unhappy with his boss and his work performance. And so he decided to, totally fake his voice and put this out on the internet. And now he's facing criminal charges. And it just sort of highlights, as some of the good stuff that you're hearing about AI, there's also a lot of dark stuff that I don't think we've come to grips with yet.
Yeah. Oh man. One more warning about AI. And from this side of the pond, I have to tell you my favorite story this week. It just struck me as very strange. I know, look, now it's spring. COVID's behind us. The dollar is strong, and so tourists, particularly American tourists, are flocking to Europe. And two things happened this week that caught my attention on that front. One is that Amsterdam voted to ban construction of any new hotels in the city because they think there are too damn many tourists there already, and they don't want any more. No more new hotels in Amsterdam. And then today's Friday, 2 days ago, here in Italy, the city of Venice started a new thing. You have to have a ticket, an entrance fee to enter the city of Venice if you're coming in as a tourist just for the day. If you're staying in a hotel overnight, you already pay an overnight fee. But they've made Venice like many of us have compared it to Disneyland. Now it is like Disneyland. You have to buy a ticket to get in just to visit the city for the day. So Amsterdam and Venice, it's going to be interesting to see what other European cities do to discourage tourists from coming or to make more money off them. So I guess my advice is, if you're thinking about a trip to Europe, do it while you still can. It may get harder and harder. And with that,
I guess you're stuck in Bologna, Bill. I'm so sorry to hear that.
I have to pay a fee to get back in the United States. Okay, guys, thank you so much. Igor Babich from HuffPost. Brian Voigtner from Off Message. Again, encourage you to subscribe. And Sarah Weyer from the Los Angeles Times. Thanks to all of you for listening as well. We'll be back Tuesday with the next edition of the Bill Press Pod. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.